Venerable Brahmali and myself have been teaching on dependent origination. And on the first day, we looked at the basis for what we're teaching on, the ground on what we're teaching on, especially talking about the early Buddhist texts, that is to say, the teachings that come from the Buddha. We looked at a little bit at the nature and the role of dependent origination as they play in the early Buddhist texts, particularly how they arose, at least partly, as a response to Brahmanical teachings, and how they have a very tightly woven and intrinsic link with the Four Noble Truths. And in fact, the whole of dependent origination can be considered as an expansion of the second and the third noble truths. And so this is an indication of how critical and how central dependent origination is within the framework of the Dhamma as a whole. We looked at the way that dependent origination functions as a teaching of how rebirth works without a self. And we showed that this dependent origination, since it operates in terms of phenomena, in terms of observable realities, then it gives us an empirical way of understanding our experience here and now, and also inferring from this to the past and the future. We looked at a few of the myths, that is to say, some of the ideas around dependent origination, which you might hear around the place, but which are not really grounded in the teachings of the suttas. For example, the idea that dependent origination is a one-lifetime model, or the idea that if you're going to talk about rebirth, you have to talk about a permanent self, and a few others. We discussed a little bit the notion of conditionality and dependency and how the different factors of dependent origination condition each other. And we looked yesterday at the first of the 12 factors in dependent origination, the factor of avijja, or ignorance. And we looked at the definition of avijja as defined in terms of the Four Noble Truths, but also rather more fundamentally about how avijja lies at the root of all of this suffering and at the root of the entire sort of cascade of dependent origination. For today, we're going to continue looking at the factors of dependent origination, and we're going to start by looking at sankhara. And I'm going to invite Venerable Brahmali to begin the discussion. One reason I'm going to do that is because I've got a specific sutta passage I want to look up. So I'll just let you do that. I'll just look that up.
Okay. Okay, so before we look at the relationship between these terms, actually I better take this off, it's otherwise too difficult. So before we look at the relationship between avijja and sankhara, ignorance and choices, or whatever you want to call it, I think it's good to have some idea what sankhara means. I think this is one of the most common questions I get, among a number of common questions. But a very common one is, what actually is sankhara? Is something that you get asked a lot. So let's, anyway, first, before we do that, the first three factors, avijja, paccaya, sankhara. Avijja leads to ignorance, leads to choices. And this is the idea. First of all, when you don't understand reality, you make bad choices. This is the first one. And the second one, second part of this, is the fact that you make choices at all. The idea that choices actually stop if you don't have any ignorance. And we'll have a look at this in detail later on to see why that actually is the case. So once ignorance is abandoned, you actually stop making choices. And the second part of this is the sankhara, choices leading to consciousness. And this also has two aspects to it. The first aspect is that choices decides the quality of your consciousness. Your quality, the nature of your consciousness is largely determined by the choices that you make. And secondly, the second factor, which is more profound, is that the very existence of consciousness depends on the choices that we make. So in both of these, there is a number of things going on. Yeah, it's not just kind of a single thing happening. Yeah? And you also need to remember that we talked yesterday about the origination side of dependent origination and the cessation side. So the cessation side then is just the flip side of the origination. Yeah. So if choices make consciousness in a certain way and choices are responsible for there being choices, consciousness in the first place, if you remove choices, well then consciousness itself must cease as a consequence. So you have both sides here going through. So this is the general idea. I'm going to look at this, or we're going to look at this in quite a bit of detail to make it clear how this actually works out in practice especially. But before we do that, we need to be a little bit clear about the definition of sankhara, what it actually means. Yeah. So meaning of sankhara. And in the suttas, the word sankhara is used in quite a number of different ways. But there are two main meanings of sankhara. One is what you call the active meaning. Yeah, in active meaning here means that sankhara creates, or it is responsible for other things. Yeah, and it kind of creates the world, if you like. And so here you have these various translations, yeah, that are possible in this active sense. And these are things like choices, yeah, which Pantasujata mentioned yesterday is his choice. Choices is his choice. I guess that's true. Yeah. Was it a moral choice or immoral? Was it? It was a neutral.
That's a very bad choice.
But so yesterday he mentioned, I think quite interestingly, that the reason why he uses the word choices is because choices has a moral dimension to it. You make bad and good choices, and that's why he chose choices. And we can also translate it as the will. Yeah, the will is a very basically, it is the thing that drives us into action. Yeah, the will behind things. Another word which is often used in kind of contemporary translation is the word volition. Volition is just another kind of fancy word for the will, really. It's more like used in philosophy sometimes, I think. Not that I know much philosophy, but that's what I hear. Another translation which is sometimes used is the idea of activities. Yeah, because when we act, actions are always driven by will. If there is no will, there is no action. So that's why we talk about activities through body, activities through speech, or activities that are purely mental. But all of these things are driven by the will. The will is behind this. We make choices all the time. Choices is more premeditated. Yeah, you make a choice. You think about it carefully. But really, sankhara also comes down to more kind of just willing in general without actually being very premeditated. The fact that we will anything is a sankhara. So whenever we do any kind of activity, it is a sankhara. And then the last one, which I quite like, is the idea of creation. Yeah, sankhara has the idea of creation. And I like that because it's quite close to the Christian idea. Let's talk about creation in Christianity. Yeah, so we're going to take one of these words from Christianity and redefine it in a Buddhist way. In Christianity, of course, creation is often the creation of the world. God creates the world, or God creates human beings. And in Buddhism, it's very similar. The world is created or sustained, yeah, just in a very similar way as creation in Christianity, by an act of will. The difference is that in Christianity, it's an act of will of God. In Buddhism, is an act of will on behalf of any kind of being. Yeah, we will the world into existence. We will our life into existence. What is the world in Buddhism? The world is a slightly different idea in Buddhism compared to Christianity. Yeah. The world in Buddhism is our personal world. Yeah, there's a very famous sutta called the Rohitassa Sutta, found in the Anguttara Nikaya 4s. 41 or something like that, 40, is it 41, 44 maybe, 44, 44, 445, something like that. It's in the 40s somewhere in the 4s. And in this sutta, the Buddha...
4.45.
45, okay. 45 and 46, so I got one of them right. So...
And Sangyutta
2.26. And Sangyutta 2.26. Oh, that's the one of the Devaputta Sangyutta. Okay, yeah. So... The idea there is that the world, from a Buddhist point of view, is just really our world. Yeah, it's our experience of things that is the world. So, and what can you say about the world apart from our experience? Well, very little. You cannot really say much about the world outside of our personal experience. Yeah, the idea of physics and the idea of the natural sciences are really all just derived from our personal experiences of the world, and that the world as we know it really is all there is as far as our, you know, our experience is concerned. So we create, in that sense, we create the world through sankharas, through actions. And it's quite interesting, the whole word sankhara is very, means almost like creation. Yeah, a kara karoti is a verb which means to do or to act or to make. Yeah, depending on various contexts. And sang usually has its idea of together, so it means almost like putting together. And putting together is like creating something. Yeah, you create a work of art, or you create you use your Lego blocks, and you kind of build something beautiful out of Lego. Do people still play with Lego in this world? Huh? Yeah, okay. Not you, Deepika. Not personally. No, okay. So, just being naughty. So, I played with Lego when I was a child. I think most people have. And so it is the creative activity, yeah, sankhara, putting together creation. So I think it would be quite nice to kind of use that word, I think, as a translation, perhaps, even though the Christians might not appreciate it, perhaps. I'm not sure whether they would. Any Christians here? No Christians. Okay, so we can be a bit naughty then. We can. Okay, so this is the active side, yeah, the creative side.
I think what you meant is we should be twice as careful. But anyway.
Is that what I meant? Okay.
Maybe.
Because of right. Okay.
But remember the
speak.
Remember in the Anekajati Sangsarang verses, you know, we sankhara gatang chittang.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so there the sankhara is like literally the deconstruction of the house.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Yeah.
We
is the opposite of the sankharas, the anti-sankhara. Yeah. Okay.
Deconstruction.
Hmm. Okay, so that is the active side of the word sankhara. And if you, whenever you read the suttas in Pali, if you ever do that, you will see that this is by far the most important usage of sankhara in the suttas. Yeah, you find sankhara in the five khandhas. Yeah, you remember the five khandhas? Five khandhas are the five aspects of a personality. Yeah, the rupa, vedana, sanya, sankhara, and vijnana. Rupa, like form, vedana, often translated as feeling, but it means feeling in a very specific way, sometimes translated as sensation, because it is a very kind of basic idea of what feeling means. It doesn't really mean emotion, it means feeling in a more simple way. Sanya, the idea, perception, yeah, our ability to make sense of the world. Sankhara, which is then the will we see right here, and then vijnana, which is consciousness. These are the considered the five aspects of a person, and there are five aspects that the Buddha has picked out specifically to investigate the person in terms of insight. That's why he gives us these particular five aspects, because this is the ground of insight, if you like. And there it means will. Yeah, the will is a very important thing to gain insight into, so we can understand the will, because we tend to take the will as a self. Then you have dependent origination, which we're looking at now. Yeah, sankhara, the second factor. Again, it has exactly that same meaning. It means the idea of will. Yeah, and there are a number of cases in the suttas where it means something close to will. Sometimes it means something which is more like a force in nature, but you know, underlying that force, of course, tends to be the will, etc. So that is by far the most common meaning of this word. But there is another meaning, and this I just want to touch on that very briefly, just to make it clear that we have a kind of more comprehensive view of what this is about. And that is what you might call the passive side of sankharas. So, for example, you will hear statements such as sabbe sankhara anicca. Yeah, sabbe sankhara, sabbe means all, anicca is impermanence. So sabbe means all sankharas are impermanent. Yeah, sabbe sankhara dukkha, all sankharas are suffering or unsatisfactory, however you want to translate that term, dukkha. And in this case, sankhara means all conditioned phenomena. Yeah, what is all conditioned phenomena? It is everything. There's nothing which is not conditioned. So everything is included within all conditioned phenomena. It's an all-encompassing group. So in that sense, Sankara is a universal appellation, universal name, yeah, for everything in the world, pretty much. Okay, so now we have the idea here. Yes, the idea then of dependent origination is that from ignorance, from a lack of seeing the world as it is, we start doing things. We start willing, yeah, we start choosing here. This is kind of the first link of dependent origination. So why is that the case? What is actually going on here? So are you ready?
Yeah.
Would you like to talk?
Sure.
Sure. You sound a little bit hesitant, but
no, I'm just seeing if we've got the things ready that I want to talk about. Okay. Yeah. Sure.
Okay.
All right. So, so we have these different senses of dependent origination: the active sense and the passive sense. And in the context of dependent origination, clearly it's an active sense because it's a condition for something. So it's that which powers it. It is the force. And now that force in Buddhism is not something which is neutral. Okay? It's not something which just happens. It has a certain quality to it or a certain property to it, and it has consequences. In the context of dependent origination, one of the keys, and I think we probably should have mentioned this earlier, but one of the keys to how we understand and interpret dependent origination is through the Vibhanga Suttas. Actually, do you want to pull up the Vibhanga Sutta while we're here? We can show people.
Should I put up the comparative study? Is that or just one of basic Vibhanga
on that? Yeah, sure. I'll just keep talking. If you could pull that up on Sutta Central, just Sangita 12.2, that would be great.
Framework here as well, if you want to see that. We have both next to each other. Is that a nice one?
I just want to see it in its context for now, just to get a basic idea of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks. So we have what we call the Vibhanga Sutta. Now, in the suttas generally, there is a pattern where the Buddha will teach a certain set of dhammas, a certain set of properties, and then he will give an explanation for those. And that explanation is called a Vibhanga. So I'm noticing that a few people are looking at this screen from quite an extreme angle, which is, I don't know if we can do anything about that because of the shape of the room, but anyway, if people want to come up the front, they can, or something. I don't know. There's some cushions at the back and maybe room for chairs at the back. Anyway, up to you, but if you want to, because it is a bit of an extreme angle. Can we pull that back? No, we can't. All right. So this is the Vibhanga Sutta, is it?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's just go up to the top of it.
Do you want
Sankara? No, just go to the top now. Okay, so we have these Vibhanga Suttas. Right to the top. Yep. Great. And for most of the major teachings, we find a Vibhanga Sutta. So we have a Magga Vibhanga to analyze the path. We have a Salayatana Vibhanga to analyze the six senses, and so on. On a larger scale, we have in the Vinaya, we have the rules for monks and nuns, which is the Parimokkha, and then we have the Vibhanga, which analyzes the rules for those. Even in later times, then in the Abhidhamma, then you have a whole book called the Abhidhamma Vibhanga, which basically collects a bunch of these Vibhangas and puts them together. Now, how these Vibhangas work is that they are a key to the understanding of these teachings throughout all of the canon. So that whenever the Buddha presented these things, he would normally present them in a brief way. But we assume that we're always following the definitions and understandings as found in the Vibhanga Suttas. Okay? This is a key to how to interpret the suttas. All right? And it's really important to understand this because not all suttas are the same. All right? If the Buddha is teaching a particular teaching in a particular time and a particular place to a particular person, then that's because that's the teaching that they needed to hear at that time. And that's different than when the Buddha gives a Vibhanga Sutta, which is how he meant everybody to understand it. This is the key to understanding all of these kinds of things. And we need to always bear in mind the explanations given in the Vibhanga, no matter where we are and no matter what context we are, that this is always an assumed knowledge. All right? So this is why when understanding the suttas, it's really critical that we don't just sort of randomly quote bits and pieces from here and there in order to support our argument. Yeah? In Christianity, they say the devil can quote scripture for his purpose. So in Buddhism, Mara can quote the suttas for his purpose. And it's very easy to take bits and pieces and to construct an argument which seems like it's plausible. But what we have to do is have some method to it and to understand that there's a reason for these things. So, for example, you can see here, this is Sanghita Nikaya number 12. That's the collection on the dependent origination. And this is Sutta number 2. So the first sutta just gives the basic teaching on dependent origination, and Sutta number 2 then gives the explanation. Everything else depends on that. And every other teaching on dependent origination all through the suttas assumes that you know what this Vibhanga Sutta is saying. Okay? So this is why it's important to understand this, and it's important to know that when we're teaching these things, that we're teaching them based on what the Vibhanga Sutta says as a starting point, and then we can enrich our understanding later on. Okay.
Yeah? Next time we should have maybe someone like Venerable Kalago dressed like Mara at the back and quoting the suttas from various angles.
Someone
we know, yeah, someone we know. Or I could take that role. But that'd be cool. We have someone to take that, and then we can see how we can kind of counter those arguments, maybe. Yeah, that'd be interesting. Yeah. Anyway, just an idea.
It absolutely is an idea. No, you're quite right. Okay.
It may not be a good idea, but that's a different matter.
All right. Can we go down to Sankaras now?
Sankaras. Okay.
Yeah.
Sankaras coming up.
All right, so each of these things has a... and we've already referred to a number of these definitions.
Okay, what are choices?
All right, what are choices? Kata me bhikkhave sankhara, tayo me bhikkhave sankhara, kaya sankharo, vachi sankharo, citta sankharo. So the choices by way of body, speech, and mind. And we'll be having a look a little bit later on at a bit of a comparative study to show how this relates to other versions. I won't reveal the plot twist just yet. So
it is exciting.
But no, it really is. It's just be this. So here it's obviously talking about the very well known. Set of actions by body, speech, and mind, right? And this is something all Buddhists are familiar with. So we know the Buddha spoke about actions by body, speech, and mind. And so this is clearly what it's talking about. Now, when the Buddha was talking about actions by body, speech, and mind, he didn't just mean, am I picking up this glasses case and putting it down, or something like that. What he was talking about was moral actions, right? That's what the Buddha was concerned about. It's not just how well you bowl a cricket ball, okay? That's a good action from a worldly point of view. If you can bowl a cricket ball well, you're doing well. But from a Buddhist point of view, that's morally neutral, unless you're playing in the Bodyline series, in which case it's bad. But what Sankara is about, the moral qualities of the actions. And this is further emphasized in other places, and I have in front of me here Sanghita. Maybe you want to open this one? What do you reckon? This is 12.51.
12.51.
Yep. You can just write 12.51 in the search.
Oh, okay.
Search. Okay. Yeah, just write 12.51. SN 12.51. 12.51. Okay. So here we have a statement on Sankaras. Okay, so avijjagato yang bhikkhave purisapuggalo punyan che sankharang abhisankaroti punyupakang hoti vijnanam. So if an ignorant individual makes a good choice, their consciousness enters a good realm. If they make a bad choice, their consciousness enters a bad realm. And if they make an imperturbable choice, their consciousness enters an imperturbable realm. But when a mendicant has given up ignorance and given rise to knowledge, they don't make a good choice, a bad choice, or an imperturbable choice. So this is giving you a nice clear example of that, the way that in Buddhism we talk about doing good deeds and bad deeds and how they lead to different kinds of rebirth. For the idea of good and bad is reasonably clear. Imperturbable is a technical term in Buddhism which relates to rebirth based on the fourth jhana or beyond. And it's called imperturbable because it's based on the experience of a neutral feeling. So it's a very kind of refined kind of good choice in a way. So somebody who has ignorance will make good choices, bad choices, and imperturbable choices depending. And just because you're ignorant doesn't mean you're making bad choices all the time. So that's one interesting thing about this. Yeah? Ignorant people do good things. Seems reasonable, right? People do good things and bad things even though they're ignorant. But then their minds go to a place which is, or their consciousness goes to a place which is generated. And so the word here, sankharang sabhisankharoti, literally to construct a construction, or to form a formation, or to activate an activity, create a creation. Yes, you get the point here. So this kind of construction you find is very common in Pali, where you repeat a word with the noun and the verb together. And so you're building up these worlds and like sending and directing your consciousness in these worlds depending on the quality of your moral choices, good, bad, or imperturbable. Thank you. So, hang on, where was I? And I think I wanted to mention, just briefly mention also while we're here, another important sutta in the context of sankharas is the Jetana Sutta.
Bring
it up? Yeah, you have that on the slides?
I do actually, but I can just...
You might as well just bring it up, yeah.
Because I'm not sure where on the slides it is.
There you go, beautiful.
Yeah.
So the Jetana Sutta. Now, if you notice, when Venerable Brahmali was with the slides earlier, he was equating the sankharas with Jetana, yeah, and karma. And so here we can see how that's why we do this. And if you see this particular sutta, what you intend or plan, yanta bhikkhave ceteti, yanta pakapeti. So these words, ceteti, which is the verb form of Jetana, and pakapeti, yancha anuseti, which you have an underlying tendency for. So especially ceteti and pakapeti are basically synonyms of sankhara. And you can see that these then form a basis for the continuation of consciousness, vijnana.
Pakapeti is quite close to sankhara.
Right, yes. And so here you can see that sometimes when dependent origination is presented, the terminology changes a bit, right? Because these words are just synonyms. You don't have to use exactly the same word all the time. But this is teaching us a little bit about how the will or the volition that we have forms a basis for the continuation of consciousness. The previous sutta was focusing more on the moral quality of that. This one is focusing more on the forcefulness of it, how it generates the consciousness in the future. Yeah? Okay, so that's just a few points on that, on sankhara. But I might just say also just more of a general point on sankhara is that we hinted a bit earlier at some of the more sort of general usages of the words. And I think that one of the big problems that we have in Buddhism generally is that we look at words as if they're kind of abstracted philosophical terms, and rather than being just the language that people were using to describe the things they wanted to talk about. And it's one of the things that study of the Vinaya is really useful for, because you get to see people talking about cleaning the toilets and all of these kinds of things, and it becomes a bit harder to imagine that this is some kind of special language that means the toilet in the ultimate sense. It's just a word for a toilet, okay? So the words that you're using are just the words for the things that you're talking about. The Vachakuti Vata. And is the Vachakuti Vata related to the Samsara Vata?
because there's a different Vata.
It's a different Vata.
Vata is different. One is round, the other one is a duta. It's a different word, actually.
Oh, that goes. There goes that theory crashing to the ground in flames. All right. So Sankara is just an ordinary word in the language, and it's used for a bunch of different things. In the Aneka Jati Sangsarang verses, it's used, we Sankara Gatang Chitang, in the context of construction, like a building is deconstructed. In the Vedic traditions, Sankara is a ritual. And a ritual is an interesting context for that. And the idea of pakapeti, to plan for something also. So I think part of the idea of a sankhara and a punyabhi sankhara, it's something which is a bit more deliberate, something which is a bit more organized than just a thought or just a flip of the mind. And I think sometimes we have become accustomed to think about sankhara in the terms made popular by the Abhidhamma. And in the Abhidhamma, sankhara often just means like any kind of activity or anything that moves in the mind. Right? And look, that's not an incorrect interpretation. Sankhara can be used in that sense. But in dependent origination, it doesn't mean that. So what that means is that you can relax a little bit, because like just a movement of the mind or a random thought or a flash or a memory or something like that is not going to get you reborn somewhere. What gets you reborn somewhere is your planned and deliberate intentions, and especially your choices of doing moral or immoral acts. That's what gets you reborn. Yeah. And so people often, because of this idea that your sankhara will generate your rebirth, they people worry a lot about the last thought moment. It was not something that the Buddha really talked about. And the last thought, the idea that the last thought is going to determine your rebirth occurs precisely twice in the suttas. In one time, it occurs in the context of Dhananjani, the Brahmin, who lived a life as a corrupt tax collector. And then after a life of crime, had a last-minute redemption on his deathbed and asked for forgiveness for all of his bad deeds, and then developed meditation on the Brahma Viharas. So this is not just talking about somebody who has a last thought moment. This is talking about somebody who feels a deep sense of shame and remorse at all many bad things he's done and completely changes his life around on his deathbed. The other example in the suttas is that of a warrior who goes into battle with his swords upraised and a mind full of hate to kill, kill, kill. And if that warrior gets killed, then yes, that state of mind that the warrior has, that will determine their rebirth, and they will go to a bad rebirth because of that. So, but these are cases where somebody at the time of death, their mind is filled with a very strong and powerful intention for good or for bad. And if that's the case, then yes, that can determine your rebirth. But most of the time, that isn't the case. Most of the time, you're lying in bed in a hospital and you're not really thinking very much at all. And you're not really planning very much at all. And your mind is mostly fairly neutral. Most of the time, our minds aren't actively involved in creating karma that's either good or bad. And if you decide to drive down to the shop to buy a bottle of milk and you have a car accident and you die along the way, then the karma of going to buy a bottle of milk is not going to determine your rebirth, okay? Assuming the accident wasn't your fault, assuming you weren't drunk and all of those kinds of things.
You get reborn in the Milky Way.
You get reborn in the Milky Way, yeah. Perhaps. So the point is that what determines this and what determines your sankharas is the moral choices that we make, and especially the moral choices that we make that we keep on making, the ones that will shape our character and shape our behavior. So don't worry, as the Buddha said to Mahanama the Sakyan, Ma bhai Mahanama, Ma bhai Mahanama, do not fear. And he asked him, Mahanama asked the Buddha, if I am walking, sometimes I stumble, and when I stumble, I lose my mindfulness, and I wonder, because I don't have mindfulness, if I die now, am I going to be reborn in a bad place? And the Buddha says, no, don't worry about it. It's okay. Can't happen. It's not going to happen. You're not going to get reborn in a bad place. So don't worry too much about it. Just focus on doing what's good, and then your mind will go to a good place if you still have ignorance. If you don't have ignorance, then, of course, you don't have any problems.
Okay, so let's have a look at how this works, even in a bit more detail than Bhante Siddhartha had just been saying. Yeah, how this process of delusion, avijja, choices, and then consciousness. I'm going to bring in consciousness as well. In other words, how these choices affect your mind. Yeah, as I mentioned before, the idea here is that, yes, it affects your rebirth consciousness, but it also affects your consciousness right here in this life. And this is one of the things the Buddha talks about. He talks about the kamma, and there's three kinds of kamma in the suttas. One is the kamma that relates to this life. One is the kamma that relates to the next life, and one is the kamma that relates to lives beyond that. Yeah, so your actions will affect your consciousness right here and now, and that is precisely why it is that you then get reborn in a particular place, because your consciousness is already stationed in a particular way in this very life. Yeah. So we'll see how much we'll look at this, but the idea here is that last time we talked about the idea of ignorance from three different perspectives. Yeah, these are often called the three characteristics in the sutta, the tilakkana, and these are the lakkanas, in other words, the marks of existence. Yeah, the way that the world actually is, according to the Buddha, and things are impermanent, things are problematic, suffering, if you like, and they are non-self. And so these are the three kind of angles on which we can look at delusions. So look at delusion from these angles and then see how that affects the choices and then how it affects consciousness. Yeah? So impermanence, suffering, and then non-self. So we start with the idea of impermanence. Yeah? So this is how the ordinary person thinks. Yeah? So this is before you start on the Buddhist path, before you start practicing. You have this idea of things in the world seeming reasonably permanent. Yeah, we are in denial very often about how fleeting things are, how they come to an end out of the blue, how things suddenly change. This is one of the biggest problems of life. That's why people grieve so much, obviously, and why they have so much suffering, because things always come to an end. We don't never really want things to come to an end. Yeah, sorry, you're fired today, then of course that's going to be problematic. Or I'm leaving you today, you know, good luck. Yeah. Then that's also usually not very nice. And so this is one of the kind of basic distortions of how we deal with existence. We see things as far more permanent than they actually are. Yeah, yeah? So in our fantasies, things don't really come to an end. Yeah, when you get married to somebody, you start a relationship, you don't think about the death of that person right away. Yeah, you have this rosy idea of living together, yeah, and you kind of don't really, it's not that we know somehow deep inside that things are going to come to an end, but it's not something that is at the forefront of our mind. And because it is not at our forefront of our mind, we are always shocked when things come to an end. Yeah, it's always unpleasant, because we, in one way we know, but another way we have also forgotten about it. It's not really become a wisdom factor, it's more like a buried kind of knowledge, which we have to be reminded of to really understand. Yeah, so, and because we don't have this idea of things coming to an end, what happens is that we chase after all these worldly things. And this chasing after these worldly things, yeah, because we forget the downside of these things, we forget that they are often problematic, we forget that one day if we attach too much to these things, we're going to have to suffer the consequences of that attachment, yeah, because we forget the downside. That is when we chase after the worldly things. So what are these worldly things that we chase after? Well, there's everything pretty much in our lives, yeah, our relationships, all the things that we own in our lives, our house, our cars, our belongings, but also beyond that, all the things that kind of give a sense of meaning in this sensory world, the worldly things, yeah, like our career, for example, the way we identify with our status in society, whatever that status might be, whether it's a status at work or a status in the the family life or in the social sense or whatever it might be, all of this is part of the worldly things that we chase after. We chase prestige, a sense of identity. Yeah, we want our we want to have an identity that is worthwhile talking about, and all of these kind of things. So we go running after things in the world, forgetting that there are some very deep-seated problems with the things of the world. When I talk about the things of the world, I'm talking about the five-sense world. I'm not really talking about the mind so much. It is true about the mind as well to some extent, but less so than in the five-sense world. And the reason is because our mind, we have some degree of control. Yeah, we can decide whether we want to be kind. We can decide how we want to live our lives. But with the world outside, basically, there's no control. Yeah, the world, well, there's a tiny bit of control. I can have this drink of water. But there's not much control. Yeah, the world outside is basically run by forces far, far larger than us individually. And so then, in our pursuit of the things of the world, pursuit of relationships, pursuit of property, pursuit of status, pursuit of all these things relating to the world, we make good and bad karma. And if our pursuit of the things of the world happens to fall in line with the idea of doing something good, yeah, we act with kindness, and that kindness leads us to the things that we are searching for in the world, then we act with kindness. But because the search for things in the world is so important to us, because that is what life is about for the majority of people around us, we are also willing to do bad things in the pursuit of worldly things. And this happens all the time. Yeah, this happens so, it's everywhere in the world. People do bad things in the pursuit of relationships. Yeah, you get a rival out of the way, or you have office politics where we are fighting with each other over the promotion or the salary increase, or we are fighting over much simpler things like the inheritance from our family, or children fighting over a toy, or an ice cream, or whatever it is. So this is endless, and the reason why it is endless is because the world, the pie of the world, is only so large. There's only so many things to go around. We tend to want the same things, and when we want the same things, we pursue this. So if we make the worldly things very important, if we forget the downside, we will be willing to do bad things in the pursuit of worldly things, because we got our priorities the wrong way around. And we'll look at this again more in a second. So we do good and bad karma, and then the sum of that good and bad karma, what does that do? That sum of good and bad karma affects our mind. If you do lots of bad things in your life, how do you tend to feel about yourself? A bit miserable. Is that right? Was anyone here who feels happy when you do bad things? That would be... if we treat somebody, I mean, there are probably some people who do that. They feel kind of happy when they do bad things to others, but
they don't put their hands up in Buddhist gatherings.
They don't put their hands up in Buddhist gatherings. That's true. They're quite, fortunately, so yeah. So the idea is that, generally speaking, if you do something bad towards somebody, you tend to feel bad about yourself afterwards. You think, oh, I shouldn't have done that. Sorry, Ben Bakaliko, for being so, naughty towards you, and whatever it is. But when you do something kind towards somebody else, if you make an offering, you say a word of kindness, or even you have a kind thought towards somebody, how do you feel? You tend to feel good. Yeah, there's a sense of lightness inside. You know that you've done the right thing. And please don't take that for granted. Yeah, when you do an act of kindness towards others, feel that feeling. Yeah, because actually, if you feel it neutrally without kind of saying, oh, no, I shouldn't feel good about what I'm doing. Yeah, but just feel it. It has a positive feeling when you do an act of kindness. Yeah, sometimes when you feel this enormous sense of wanting to be generous towards somebody, you just give. It can be a very powerful and beautiful feeling when that kind of becomes just right and it kind of works out for you in the right way. So what happens here is that our consciousness, there's a balance between the bad things that we do and the good things that we do. And of course, the majority of things are pretty neutral, don't have much effect at all. As Bhante Sujata was saying, sankharas really is the force of the intention is very, very important for how strong the thing is. If it's a very strong intention, you really dwell on it, and you really kind of, yes, I'm going to do something good, yeah, not don't do the bad, just good, then it's going to have a powerful effect on your mental state. And you can, so you can see what is happening in a sense is that if you live really well, your consciousness is kind of, it lifts, yeah? It's like it's untethered. The things that tether the consciousness to the ground are the bad actions. It's like the sandbags in an, you know, when you have an air balloon, yeah? And you have sandbags in the little kind of basket underneath, yeah, where you're sitting in, and you chuck out the sandbags. That's like not doing the bad karma, cutting the tethers that hold you to the ground. It allows the balloon to soar, yeah, and this is the consciousness rising. And then you fill more helium into the balloon. Don't fill hydrogen, because then it will explode. Use helium. Helium is the good karma, yeah? Hydrogen is, what is that? I'm not sure what that is. That's where you try to do something good, but you fail somehow. I don't know. So lots of helium in the balloon, lots of good karma, and then the balloon rises. You cut off the tethers that hold it down, throw out the sandbags, and it starts to rise up. And you feel that inside. You feel brighter. You feel lighter. You feel more clarity in the mind. Yeah, all of these things coming together. You feel generally more happy and content in life when these things happen. And one of the most interesting things about the spiritual path, if you get the spiritual path right, is that generally your mind starts to, this is what happens to the mind, yeah? It starts to kind of become lighter and brighter and more beautiful over time. I don't know, I've been a monk for quite a while, not quite as long as Bandha Sujata, but not so far behind actually, 25 years.
Seems like yesterday, doesn't it?
It seems very short, yeah.
Right?
But when, yeah, so that's a bit dangerous, isn't it? It seems short, but I'm a bit worried about that.
I don't know.
Yeah,
I'm wondering where this whole kind of wisdom thing kicks in.
Yeah.
they told us.
They said something when we started out, that's right. Gee, let's not divulge too many secrets of the monastic life. Because it... happens, yeah? When, and this is the connection here between avidya, ignorance, choices, and then consciousness. And of course, consciousness, because it then rises up, consciousness is always changing depending on our actions. And wherever that consciousness is, yeah, at a particular time, and usually it is fairly stable, your consciousness tends to be fairly stable in a place, it's gradually moving up and down. Of course, it can go... The general level, if you like, the base of consciousness is fairly stable. That's called the Vijnanatitti, which means the station of consciousness, yeah, the plane of consciousness. And because the consciousness has a certain plane already in this life, that's where it moves on into the future. And then your rebirth happens according to that. Yeah. In other words, your inner psychology matches you can call it external, even though it might not be external in the real sense, in a sensory sense. The inner psychology matches how you get reborn. Yeah, the inner mind state decides that kind of level of rebirth. So at that moment when you're reborn, then the inner psychology and the outer world, they match. But then over life, yeah, you, even though the body, if you like, the five senses are stuck in a certain plane, the consciousness can actually change. Yeah, and it changes over a lifetime, and then at the end of the lifetime, it may be stationed in a different level, and then you get reborn according to the new level. Yeah, then you're stuck sensory for a while, the mind changes again, and then this is how it kind of develops over time. Anyway, so this is the basic idea. But the good thing is that we come to the Buddhist teachings, or we come to a spiritual teaching, and we decide that we're going to learn something about reality. And one of the first things we start to see is this. Things are less permanent than we thought they were. Yeah, we start to reflect on life. We realize that with a little bit of reflection, it is not hard to see that things are far more impermanent than we think. What happens then? Well, what happens then? Well, we start to think about life in a new way. And this is some of the beautiful similes that I always read out whenever I teach a meditation retreat or do these courses. One of my favorite similes is called the simile of the borrowed goods. And if you want to look it up, it is found in the middle-length sayings of the Buddha, Sutta number 54, called the Potalya Sutta. It has all these marvelous suttas on the downside of the sensory world, yeah? And the simile of the borrowed goods is one of these classic similes. And basically, the idea is that everything in the sensory world is like a borrowed good. Yeah, everything that we have it for a while. And then after a while, it disappears like a relationship. How long do we have a relationship for? Some relationship might last for a few decades, and then you die. Eventually we have to die. But very often relationships are much shorter than that. They may last a couple of years, or sometimes they don't last all that long at all. So a relationship is like a borrowed good. You have it for a while. Yeah, all the things in your life, your house, your car, your all the goods that you have, whatever you have accumulated in your life, they're also borrowed goods. Yeah, you have these things for a while. And then, at the very latest when you die, very often much earlier, you will have to give them up. And because death is so uncertain, and because it always tends to come out of the blue, very often we have to give these things up before we really are ready to give them up. Again, people in our life, even our parts of our inner life, are connected to the sensory world. Yeah, the things that have to do with, I mentioned before, like our sense of identity, who we take ourselves to be, is very often connected with external things. Yeah, whether you are educated or not, whether you think of yourself as intelligent or not, what kind of social status you have, whether you consider yourself as rich and poor, yeah, all of these kind of things, they give us an identity. And it's all based on this very flimsy ground, which is the things on the external world. It's all borrowed. Our identity is also like the borrowed goods. So what does this mean in practice? Well, what it means is that if you imagine yourself, if you are renting a car or renting an apartment, what is your attitude to that rented car? What is your attitude to that rented apartment? How much effort are you going to put into it? How much attachment are you going to build up to something that you rent? Not that much, right? You have an apartment for two or three months. You know you're going to have to give it up afterwards. You're not going to invest an enormous amount of time and money and of your personality into that apartment, because it's the owner who will have the benefit of that if you do that. Yeah, so you think about things in a different way. Yeah, and the problem in life is that we tend to think of things as if we own them, as if that we are really in charge. And that is why we tend to be so upset when they disappear. But if instead you think of everything in your life as something borrowed, start imagining the things in your life as borrowed. Your attitude to those things actually starts to change as well. You don't take them so seriously. You start to think about life in a different way. And instead of being so concerned about the things of the world because you're not the borrowed, you start to be concerned instead about how you live your life. How the process of life, whether you live with kindness, whether you live with care, and these kind of things. This is what starts to matter instead of the things of the world, which are so really out of control. This is extraordinarily useful. This is really a kind of core part of the Dhamma teachings. And the more you are able to think about the world in this way, it also is very, very beneficial for meditation practice, because it allows you to let go a little bit of the worldly things. And when you let go of the worldly things, of course, that is exactly where meditation starts to happen. So there's less avidya. You can see here there's a declining of avidya, a declining of ignorance, right view. There's a little bit of right view there. Not that much yet, but a little bit of right view. So let's move on, because I'm getting a bit stuck here. This is another idea of which is kind of nice, to remind yourself of the impermanence of things. And this is a reflection that I learned from Ajahn Brahm a long, long time ago. I don't know, 2 decades ago. Remember that reflection? The and then what reflection?
No, I don't.
You don't remember that? No? Okay, maybe you weren't there.
Maybe I wasn't paying attention.
Maybe you were. That was your chance. That was your opportunity to catch up on these ancient wisdoms. So this is the Ajahn Brahm's famous and then what reflection. And this is the reflection of, when you see, when you go to the movies, at the end, or you read a fairy tale. When you read a fairy tale, the prince and the princess always kind of end up together at the end of the fairy tale. That's why it's called fairy tale. It's not all that real. But actually, they are real. That's the problem. Because Gandhabas are real. So fairy tales are more real than we thought they were. Anyway, that's a sidetrack. So fairy tales,
Okay.
So the problem with fairy tales is that they are not super duper realistic. It ends up with the prince and the princess kind of getting each other, and then kind of, and as it always says at the end of the fairy tale, they live happily forever after. that this is how we grow up, right? We get told these things as children. They live happily forever after. And of course, it is complete nonsense. We get imprinted with right view from the we're small, young, innocent, ignorant, no idea what's going on, and this wrong view that's planted into us. And of course, we start. It's not that we believe it 100%, but it's enough for us to kind of have a feeling that there's something true to this, yeah? And we get deluded by these kind of things.
Should we have Buddhist fairy tales?
Should it be fairy tales or should it? Yeah, okay. Yeah, you.
Well, like one. Well, you know, prince and princess get married, and then they're very happy, and then they suffer from depression. They have to quit the royal family, go to California, start up a new life, advocating for mental health. I don't know. I'm just riffing here on possibilities, but it's.
Yeah.
It seems that these things don't actually work out quite the way that we think. I don't know. Life is
so wise. Where wisdom come from? Yeah. That's very, very impressive. Now there you are. That's the wisdom that you were talking about before. You know. So. And the same thing with movies, yeah? In the movies, you see the hero kind of riding off into the sunset, yeah? That's kind of the last kind of Clint Eastwood rides off into the sunset, yeah? You've seen those kind of the good, the bad, and the ugly, or whatever they call it. And these are the things I saw when I was back in the 1980s. Of course, the reality is that the hero rides off into the sunset. What happens then? Well, then he has to go back home. Then he has to wash the dishes, yeah? And then he has an argument with, he and his wife have an argument, because this is what happens when you live together all the time. Sometimes, occasionally, you have the argument.
I don't think Clint Eastwood was washing the dishes.
This is the thing. This is where you might be deluded, you see. Even Clint Eastwood might be washing the dishes. I don't know.
I think he expected his wife to wash the dishes. But anyway.
Maybe the Clint Eastwood of the movies was like that. Okay, anyway, whatever. You are destroying this whole point, Bhante. This is not going to work out. Yeah.
Ignore me.
So... Yeah. Anyway, the life is so different. Yeah. And this is exactly the problem of our existence. And in fact, the Buddha has one of his similes, and we'll come to this later on, I think, is precisely the simile of the dream. Yeah. The dream of the future is very different than the reality. So when we ask the and then what question, yeah, it's like you are a monk and you think, monastic life isn't that, you know, it's not, it may be disrobable, would be a good idea, maybe kind of getting into a relationship. And then I think, but and then what? What after that? You tend to stop at the point where you get into the relationship and you forget what happens after that. Yeah, this is the problem. So what happens after that? Wait a minute. Okay, then have to do the dishes. But I'm not Clint Eastwood, so I have to do the dishes, you see.
You would be a modern husband.
That's a scary thought. Okay, yes. So you have to do the dishes, and then of course you think that you find exactly the right person to have a relationship with, but it turns out actually you don't. Yeah, because you are just as silly as everyone else, so you end up becoming like your parents. Yeah, this is always the case, and that's kind of. My parents are actually quite good. Still, I don't want to be like my parents. And this is the end then what? It's actually a very beautiful way of thinking about life. And of course, at the end of it all, even if you have a really, really good relationship, you're going to have to die. Yeah, you're going to have to say goodbye one day. And if the relationship is great, you're going to be really attached to that person because you had a really good time together. Yeah? So this is the idea of the and then what? Yeah, it breaks so much of the delusion of samsaric existence. It sees through the veil. It sees through this distortion that we always kind of have with us. This is kind of an arising or right view. I like this one because it is actually found in the suttas, because a variation on the dream. Simile, I think. Yeah. So we look this, and because of all of this, we become less interested in the things of the world. Yeah. We see the downside of the things in the world, and so you become more interested in the spiritual path. You realize that if happiness is not to be found externally, well, then it must be found within. Yeah. And this happens then through living well. As I said before, you build up the good qualities inside. Yeah. So the sankharas change. You have different sankharas. You live in a new way. And as I usually say, in the process, than the results of life. Chasing after worldly things is always about going for the results. Yeah, we want that relationship, we want that job, we want that career, whatever it is. But the results are unreliable. We never know whether we're going to be able to have that relationship. And even if we have it, it might stop after some time. So instead of worrying about things that we cannot reliably have, which are always going to be uncertain and we just don't know, we're concerned about the process. Because in the process of acquiring things, in the process of living, that's where we make the comma. So we make sure we get the process right. Yeah, in our search for the things of the world, we do things with kindness. We do things with care. We try to avoid doing the negative things. And then if the result doesn't work out, at the very least, we have the inner happiness. We have something that we can take with us into the future. Yeah. And whereas the person who does bad things to gain the worldly things, well, sometimes they don't even get the result. And on top of that, they have created a negative feeling inside of them, so they get to lose out on both accounts. So this is kind of, you change your attitude to things. You look at the process. The process is actually what starts to matter to you rather than the results. Because the results, you just don't know. Just like Sutta Central, you never know what's going to happen with it. You never know when people are going to do what they're supposed to be doing, et cetera, et cetera. We just, yeah, anyway. So what happens next? And then you make less bad karma and more good karma, yeah, because you actually take more interest in the spiritual life, because you know the life of the sensory world is precisely unreliable. As you make more good karma, less bad karma, your consciousness is affected. This is where the consciousness starts to lift up, yeah, starts to take off. It becomes brighter and better because you are stopping the bad stuff and doing the good stuff.